This is Kaleidoscope. Today, Melwyn Merchant talks with his friend, the consistently brilliant playwright, Christopher Fry.
So far in this series of discussions, we've had a broadcast with a painter, John Piper, with a sculptor, Barbara Hepworth, and now we come to our third artist, Christopher Fry, a dramatist. And here, of course, the problem is quite different. For the dramatist, unlike the painter and the sculptor, is dependent on other people to interpret his work. The first impression I think I have constantly with me of Christopher Fry is of enormous vitality. If you like, the sheer fun of the man. A lot of people find him grave, quiet. He is, after all, of Quaker stock. But in his company, there's usually a very great deal of laughter all the time. I want you to hear him not as that especially great writer, the man of outstanding genius, but as a person who can quietly and amusingly talk about his work and how it comes into being. I'd like to start with what is for me the central problem of the dramatist. You write a work that is complete in itself. You have wanted to write it, but it goes out into the world pretty well at the mercy of directors and actors. How troubling a fact is that?
Quite considerably troubling, really. At first, it didn't trouble me very much. One felt that actors were the people who could carry the thing that you'd written, and that directors are the sort of people who could understand what you were talking about. Also, I felt then, perhaps naively, that the words were there, and to the audience, almost however spoken, the words would still remain the same and be understood in the same way. But of course, this isn't at all true. The quality that the director and the actor bring to the words makes all the difference in the world. And indeed, the intention can be nullified, almost probably reversed, the meaning reversed by the way it's performed. And then you come to the difficult thing of getting to know the actors in rehearsal, and they may be miscast, they may be physically wrong in some way, either too lightweight for the part or whatever it may be. But you become so fond of them during rehearsal because they're working so hard and are so anxious that you begin to make compromises in your own mind. This is also true, of course, with the director, that you go along with what he's doing as far as you possibly can go, so that your original conception gets a bit misty.
But do you find that the new conception is perhaps an extension, or even perhaps, if one dare say it, an improvement on the original idea?
One would like to. I think this has occasionally happened, but not I think, very often. Whether this is because in writing you are directing it yourself, to a certain extent, and acting it, too, so that it's difficult to make the change in your mind.
There are two conditions that I'd like to consider with you. One day, you will have been dead as long as Shakespeare is today. In 300 years, people will be performing your plays. They will be performing them very differently.
Yeah.
Is that worrying?
Sometimes it worries me. Sometimes I think I should put a great many more stage directions. Initially, I was against this idea. Having been a director myself, I thought a director should be free to conceive it in his own way and not be led all the time by the writer. But after seeing different productions, finding that things which you thought were implicit in the text and that in fact were not, then it seems to me it would be better to leave some kind of text which would be foolproof.
But there's a second condition, you see, that is diametrically opposite to that. Quite a number of your plays have been written with a particular actor or actress in mind. Gielgud, Dame Edith Evans, Sir Laurence Olivier.
Well, not Gielgud.
Gielgud.
The latest Not Forbearing was originally written for Alec Clune. It was Alec Clune's panache and sense of comedy, I think, that in a way shaped the character of Thomas Mendip. And then, of course, with the Edith Evans play, The Dark is Light Enough, there were things that I very much wanted to say. And the idea that was in my mind was to try and show a relationship between the divine and the human, or between the whole and the part. But as I was also commissioned at the time to write a play for Edith Evans, this meant, in fact, that Gettner had to say, God's a woman.
Yes.
Or a woman has the characteristics and ambiguities of God.
In this play, a very powerful woman, the Countess, meets her salon every Thursday. Her son-in-law, Gettner, is fleeing from an invading army. He rushes into the salon and frantically asks for sanctuary.
Who can I trust here? I know I offend these gentlemen's opinion of the world, and not one of them cares what becomes of me.
Gettner, Gettner, have some respect for yourself.
Have a respect for my life. For the sake of your sleep to come, don't betray me. Go to your imaginations, gentlemen. Think of death by shooting.
I should more likely weep for stags or partridges. And with this contemptuous speech, Gettner appears to be dismissed. But the Countess now comes back.
Do then. Weep for what you can. It's grateful to our brevity to weep for what is briefer, for nothing else will.
And in the wonderful charity of that speech, which you remember Edith Evans did so superbly, I thought that there was the emotional core of the play. Given a commission by the Religious Drama Society to produce a play for touring, which shall have not more than four men and no women in the cast, and that this is to be performed in churches, you produced the brilliant solution of A Sleep of Prisoners, in which you lock four prisoners of war into a church. How constricting was that?
It wasn't. It was releasing, rather. And in a curious way, I think I've missed it ever since, that I've found it more constricting to think I was writing for a theatre, particularly the proscenium theatre, I suppose. The whole thing of having that church building and the characters free to roam about it, not being restricted to one particular corner of the church, it gave me a great freedom, I think.
How does the idea of a play generally occur to you?
I don't know where one puts the beginning, quite, because it rarely arises from the whole of one's experience and life generally. At which point do you say the play begins? In fact, the ideas that you're forming in life are gradually leading you to the point at which you want to write a play in which you can try to interpret those years and what you've learnt from them. So that, in fact, there is no moment of beginning for a play until we come to a point at which a play must be written. And then, of course, it's a question, I think, the ideas are there which help you to find the kind of story that you need to express these ideas. Yeah. But finding the story is an almost mechanical thing. I mean, I think when I was searching for a way of saying what I wanted to in the latest Not Forbearing, I bought 13 volumes of the great short stories of the world and searched.
Was there an idea before the Duchess and her friends came into being? Did you have something to say about human relations, something about war and about peace, about compassion?
Yes, yes, indeed. The central idea was to find the relationship between the whole and the part between the divine and the human. This was the jumping off ground. So that the central figure, which had to be a woman, had also to be a center of a circle. This meant the Countess with her weekly salon.
So that the marriage of Gärtner to her daughter and the tensions of being across two frontiers, of being Austrian-Hungarian, of being involved in a war that traversed the frontiers inside a family, that is a secondary idea.
Well, it's secondary in a way, though it's all very much part of the same idea. I think to have this feeling of the whole working on the part and the part searching for the whole, it was necessary to have a situation such as a war, a moment of crisis, where the ordinary material routine of life was broken up.
Well, then, the play that came next, Kurt Mantle, Henry II and Becket. And again, if I may simply interject a personal opinion here, I would have said that even including Eliot's great Murder in the Cathedral, your Kurt Mantle is still, for me, the great Becket play. How did that play start?
The beginning of that was so long before I actually wrote it. I remember talking to Laurence Olivier about it in 1950, and it wasn't written until 1960. It started then just from reading A Life of Henry II and becoming interested in the character as a man and his contradictions. And keeping it in my mind over the years, it grew from that. That rarely was a case, I think, of growing less from an idea than from a historical character.
I think that the argument between Henry and Becket focuses itself very much on the discussion where the king and the archbishop are talking of the function which Becket is going to perform if, in addition to being archbishop, he becomes chancellor of the state. Of course, Henry sees it because he wants to see it in very simple terms. And this is how he introduces Becket's argument about his own status. Becket asks, what is natural in an archbishop? And Henry replies, precisely what is natural in Tom Becket. Your election is simple. To the majority of men, inevitable.
One thing is simple. Whoever is made archbishop will very soon offend either you, Henry, or his God. I'll tell you why. There is a true and living dialectic between the church and the state which has to be argued forever in good part. It can't be broken off or turned into a clear issue to be lost or won. It's the nature of man that argues, the deep roots of disputation which dug in the dust and formed Adam's body. So it's very unlikely, because your friend becomes primate of England, the argument will end. As Chancellor, my whole mind could speak for yours, because I knew the church had for her tongue a scholar and a saintly man who was not to be browbeaten. But now Theobald is dead. The English church has lost its tongue. Do you mean that I should now become that tongue to be used in argument between you and me? Because if so, we shall not be as we have been.
And of course, Henry doesn't want to understand him at all, and simply turns the whole agonized argument aside with, you will miss your Falklands, of course. You're a very disciplined writer, and I wonder if you could describe the way in which a day and a week and a period of writing operates.
It alters a good deal from time to time, but it starts with sitting down at my typewriter for office hours, I mean, always at the same time and breaking off at the same time. And it's a process of finding my way, of enormous amount of revision. I think I can't say manuscript, because it's never in handwriting, or very rarely in handwriting, but on the typewriter. I find the typewriter, it It's a very old one. It's a 1914 model. And therefore very noisy.
Been described as the most musical typewriter in the world, yes.
And there's something about the noise it makes, that hard, clanking noise, which I find very helpful somehow. One feels that you're getting something down onto paper, yes. Even though you may cancel it all the next day. But the amount of the pages that went to make the play would be enough to sit on at a snack bar counter. It's so high. So it's a question of continually revising and retyping and retyping.
This will take weeks, perhaps months, perhaps even a couple of years.
Yes, I think Kurt Mantel took 2 years.
I can remember very vividly. You're talking about Kurt Mantel about halfway through the writing of it. And you used an image then. You said that a speech, an important speech of Beckett's at the end of Act One, had to be balanced, and you put your hand out as if you were stretching your hand out over a map. You said that has to be balanced by another speech of Henry's over here, pointing towards the end of Act Three. Mm. Now, does this mean that you work as much almost as an architect as you do as a poet when you're writing a play?
Yes, I think I do. Sometimes, I suppose, I see it in a almost a musical form. For instance, in the comedies, there is usually a central duet, as it were, between the man and the woman. Certainly, architecture comes into it, I think, because the whole shape and building of a single speech and then how that relates to the general shape of the scene is important to me. It also has some sort of feeling of painting, the necessity of a certain kind of tone or colour at a certain moment. Yes. In the whole shape of the thing.
So that you're checking and balancing each part of the structure, anticipating what is going to happen at the end of Act Three, even while you're writing Act One.
Yes, that is true.
So that the sonata form really is being conceived in all its movements at the same time.
Yes.
This does mean very disciplined writing then, doesn't it?
It's probably the reason why I revise so much, because it's not something, I think, which is totally conscious. That is to say, I couldn't plan it on a piece of paper for you before I started writing, only in a very general way. But I do know as I'm writing, the feeling is that something is missing here. It's a question of just working towards something of which you're not totally aware.
Well, of course, even an abstract painter or an abstract sculptor will know this, yeah, that there are volumes that have to be balanced over against each other. I very much doubt whether any dramatist has been quite so dominated in his reputation by one play, to my way of thinking unjustly, as you have. So many people will think of you as the author of The Lady's Not for Burning, and great numbers of critics have perhaps felt resentful that The Lady's Not for Burning has not happened two or three times afterwards. Do you consider yourself primarily as a writer of comedy or of tragedy?
Oh, comedy, I think. I'm sure. Certainly in the classical sense, I've never written anything like tragedy. Comedy, after all, is a point of view or an angle of experience. And the fact that I believe, above all things, that there is pattern and purpose in life means surely that I'm really a comic writer. And I mean, it's quite true that the number of the plays deal with death in some way or another. But then creation God, whatever, however you like to put it, doesn't seem to take death very tragically or even very seriously.
I would have said that Kurt Mantel
Well, that certainly comes as near to it as anything I've done, I think.
Well, here you've got a great king, much of whose life vision is frustrated. You've got a great archbishop who could have been the great ally of the great king, and their mutual greatnesses smash each other. Now, that seems to me to be very nearly classical as a formula for tragedy.
Yes, very nearly. I would I'll give you very nearly. But I think, if you think of Kurt Mantle, it's very much more concerned the devastation comes rather from the, I was going to say blindness, but the one-eyedness of the characters, the almost stupidity of the human being. If that is tragic, then yes.
Oh, but surely that is a major element in tragedy, isn't it?
Yes.
Or
yes,
if you take a standard that I very frequently use for tragedy, the tragedy is irredeemable loss. Well,
yes.
Here is the loss of a friendship and the loss of two kinds of potential career.
Yes, well, if that is your definition, then I agree. I think
yes.
Perhaps that is there.
And here, of course, also, had there been peace, then Gettner would have been at peace in a way in which he isn't, in The Dark is Light Enough. Even The Dark is Light Enough has, for me, overtones of tragedy.
Yes, but it's very much more a creation of Gettner. We start with Gettner, who is totally separated from God. And there's a resolution of that, isn't
yes.
there? He finds himself.
But of course, in this sense, King Lear is a very great comedy, in that by the end of King Lear, despite the fact that Cordelia now lies dead in his arms and he dies of a broken heart, King Lear has found himself.
And of course, I always think of the Book of Job as a comedy.
Oh, yes, yes. But I think that the Book of Job has a quality of final resolution that is not present in what I would regard as your great tragedies. And even in the Book of Job, of course, one has to remember the sons and the daughters are irredeemably lost. There's nothing
yes.
that will restore that,
no,
whatever else
no,
comes to take
no.
their place. But, of course, this is a matter very much of definition. Now, a quite different sort of question. You've done a number of films with distinguished directors, with Wyler, Ben-Hur, Fleischer, Barabbas, and the Bible film with John Huston. Has working in a large-scale team, like a film, been for you a creative challenge, or has it been a rather drastic limitation?
I don't think either, really. It's been a great help at moments when working alone on a play has sometimes been depressing. There is only yourself to blame. Whereas working with a team, of course, there are a lot of other people you can blame eventually, which is very useful. Also, I found that whereas I'd often wondered whether I could do some work at a reasonable speed instead of very slowly, as I usually did, moments occur, of course, making a film, where you have to do something on the spur of the moment. I remember times when I walked onto the set when Willie Wyler was there, and I just got on to say goodbye before I went home, I hoped. And he would say, "We were just looking for you. The actors want some more lines in this scene. Have you an envelope in your pocket, and can you write them?" And I would have to write them there and then and hand them across to the actors, which meant that this was during the ride when I had already started Kurt Mantle, in fact, and had found it hard going. And I think when I returned to Kurt Mantle after that experience, I had a good deal more feeling that I could do the work with a certain speed.
I don't think I could bear to finish even a casual talk with you without some introduction of The Lady's Not for Burning. The opening where I think Richard Burton made pretty well his first West End appearance as Richard. And so amusingly and wryly speaks of his status in society as an orphan. Alison is speaking to him towards the beginning of the play. Are you his brother?
No. All I can claim as my flesh and blood is what I stand up in. I wasn't born, I was come across. In the dusk of one Septuagesima, a priest found an infant, about 10 inches long, crammed into the poor box. The money had all been taken. Nothing was there except myself. I was the baby, as it turned out. The priest, thinking I might have eaten the money, held me upside down and shook me, which encouraged me to live, I suppose, and I lived.
Melwyn Merchant, poet, librettist, sculptor, and master teacher, who heads the Department of English at the University of Exeter in Great Britain, has been talking with Christopher Fry. These programs are recorded in the London studios of the CBC with the assistance of Anne Wright. Producer, Lester Sugarman.